they said manufacturers of magnetic equipment. So I was wondering, they call it a magnometer. Guess that's the way it's pronounced. M-A-G-N-E-T-O-M-E-T-E-R. Take over.
I have an answer. Go ahead, Wesley. Okay, magnetometer. If you have a magnet with a south pole and a north pole, and you might use the Gauss, it is being called also the Gauss meter, with the hull probe on it. Then, obviously, when it's zero, then you have a plus and minus, and from zero to five represents the certain power of the magnetic field. Back to you.
So I think you're saying if I put it near the plus end of the magnetic field, it'll move positive. If I put it near the north pole, and if I put it near the south pole, it'll move negative. And how far it moves tells me how strong is the local magnetic field. Maybe that's what a magnetometer reads. I know that Glenn wanted to add some further information to all of the above. KC2QIQ, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I forgot to mention something when you get down.
You're on. Glenn first.
Yes, quick comment that, you know, things on PC boards that I didn't hear mentioned, but, you know, one of the things that normally comes up a lot of times when you're making PC boards is the thickness of the board, deciding what how thick do you want your board to be. I find, you know, like a lot of electronic circuits can be built on like 060,000 or 062. It seems to be a good, like, working hobby thickness of boards. And also, I don't really make any boards at home. I think maybe I etched one or two boards in my life. But I found that just, you know, being able to use, you know, any kind of a CAD program to produce a PCB and then basically sending it out, you know, to either email it or send it, to a PC board house, CAD files, basically it comes back so nice and, it's a very neat operation, and then you can either choose a house to actually do the prototyping and actually mount the components on for you, or do that yourself, which I usually like to do myself as, you know, being a hobby, so I like to actually pull out the soldering iron from time to time. K4IWKC2QIQ.
That's the way Glenn does it. Eric's got some further information. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that Yahoo has a group dedicated to making PC boards. What they do nowadays is they take these inkjet printers that are intended for CD printing, and they modify them to print directly on the PC board.
That's one very nice way of putting the resist. And Wesley was telling us about this process he knows about, where you print this material onto a piece of paper or something like that, and you do it in reverse, lay it on the PC board, and hit it with 90 degrees centigrade, which is 194 degrees Fahrenheit, and the transfer occurs of the resist material. Back to you, Wesley, and how many PC boards do you think you're going to be building in the near future? N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Before I go to that, I didn't hear from Eric, what is the model number of the CNC that you've got, and what is the manufacturer, and how much did you pay for it? Back to you.
Okay, Eric, the CNC, he wants to know what model number and how many dollars, and if I know Wesley, he'd probably like to know if he buys it from eBay, what is he likely to pay?
No, the CNC that I use, which is easy, it's actually intended for jewelers and that kind of stuff. It's not a big, heavy machine. It's a company called MaxNC, M-A-X-N-C, Nancy Charlie. They have a website. Their small machines are like $1,400. Their bigger machines are still under $2,000. You can find them on eBay for like $600 to $700.
And what is the max, the maximum size, the area that you can mill? Back to you.
Say that again.
Yeah, he wanted to know what is the maximum area. How many centimeters horizontal and vertical will your max numeric control, max-NC stands for numeric control, how many centimeters horizontally and vertical will it accommodate the $1,400 machine, for instance? Over to you, Eric.
No, it's not incredibly large. I don't remember. I think it's like about 6 by 8 inches for the small one. The bigger one will do 15 inches. I have the smaller one. It's fine for what I do.
Okay, 6 by 8 inches. That's one of the answers you wanted, Wesley. Back to you, Wesley.
Okay. Well, what I'm dealing right now with is it's 3 by 3 inches board, and instead of doing the one big board for the project that I'm doing, actually, I'm not manufacturing them right now. They are being made in Poland right now, and when my wife is going to that up and bring it to me, and it cost me zero. It's just a favor from the ham radio operator from Poland. And but I did dozens, I would say a few hundreds of them in my lifetime, and I believe I could refresh that. Now, the typical method that I taught you about is the choke. The choke, the white choke that you use on the board in the classroom, that is the paper, photographic paper, that contains the chalk in it. Excuse me for the improper wording, but this is a kind of glossy paper. Now, what's happening is that the ink does not really penetrate that, but it's on it. And when it's on it, then you actually, when you put this reverse on the PCB, then all you need is just the iron to put on it to make that ink stick into the printed board. And because the printed board is able to glue it kind of, and the paper is with that slicky material that I call it choke, then when you actually after use your iron, when you
what repeater timeout repeater timeout cancel.
Okay, so what you're calling the choke, I think you mean the resist. So the resist material is on this shiny paper that gets ironed onto the very clean PC board with a clothes iron running at 90 degrees centigrade, and it transfers itself over to the PC board, and then it's ready for the etching process. Sounds like you've done that very well. Sounds also like the Polish amateurs know how to do that, and your wife's picking up those PC boards for you. Okay, we've been on this subject now for a little bit over an hour. I'm going to go to the next person, Wesley, and keep us informed as to how your project is going. The next person who signed in with a question was Anthony, WW2W. Hope we haven't put you to sleep, Anthony.
It's the magnometer.
Go ahead, Anthony. WW2W, Anthony, are you there? Okay, maybe he got called away. Did somebody talk about the magnetometer? He's got some further information on that. Please give us your call letters and your name, sir.
Let me give you a last comment on the last subject.
Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that there's stuff called green TRF, which is for thermal transfer. You pass it through a laser printer, and then what you really should do, rather than use an iron, is you use one of these devices that is intended for sealing, you know, cards. I forget what they call it. It's two hot rollers, and that's kind of the best way to do it. The other way is photographically, they make a film, which is heat transferred. You develop it, forms a resist. And if you really want to get really professional results, what you do is you plate it. You plate the board just like you would be plated through holes. I mean, it's a process. It's all listed on the it's all listed on that website that I gave you. But you do that kind of thing and you get excellent results. I'm done. K2RW, K2J.
Didn't get the website. You've got to repeat it for me. I have a difficulty to understand it.
He wants you to run the website where you're going to get all that information one more time. Eric, go ahead.
All right, they have an entire manual of both mechanical etching and photographic etching and transfer etching. It's Tink, T-H-I-N-K, T-I-N-K .com, and they also sell material.
Okay, T-H-I-N-K, T-I-N-K, thinktink.com. QSL, Wesley?
Got it. Thank you very much.
Okay, one more call for Anthony, if he's there. WW2W. I think I got his call letters correct. Anthony, if you have a question, K2RIW in the TechNet. I think Anthony's not there. The next person with Paul, WS2N. I hear tell that you visited Andy and got some reasonably nice results as the first step of the troubleshooting of that twitching power supply that's inside of your digital television set. And you might want to tell us a couple of words about that if you want to, Paul. Or you can just flip right over to your space report if you want to. The choice is yours. WS2N, K2LIW. You got it, Paul.
Okay, very good. Oh, yeah, we went over there. My son-in-law and I, and what we did was, I'd say, in probably 40 minutes, Andy had this thing figured out. And I know you said 15, but it took us about 40. He did very, very, very well. If it wasn't for all the instructions and things that he was telling me, I think time would have been a lot shorter. Very, very informative. Naturally, I asked a million questions, and but before you know it, he went through through this board. I did a few things before, but he quickly deducted this whole board. You know, the high voltage side of the board, the low voltage side of the board, and showed me the difference between the two. You can tell the difference. But he pulled the bridge rectifier out and tested that. That was good. Diagram. I know the standard bridge diagram. Let me drop it. You know, of the four diodes that are arranged and the four points coming off the those four diodes. Well, this is one package and showed me that, you know, where the inputs and the outputs would be and how to test them. And that turned out to be good. He re-soldered that back on the board. By the way, very good at soldering. I mean, it's unbelievable to see these pieces come out and then put back in so quickly. Very quick. A couple of other components, and his guess was the switching transistor. There were two identical ones there. Pull both of them out. And that's what he was aiming for right from the beginning. He said switching transistor sensor.
Chigukchi.
Tested both of them. One was good and the other one was not. They were hooked up in parallel. So the theory goes that, you know, one failed and the other one didn't. It could be likely that one is no good. So he's going to come up with another one. And that's where we're at. And that completely eliminated the short going back to the fuse, which was, you know, the initial problem, of course. The drop at WS2N.
KC2YLQ.
Whiskey, whiskey to whiskey.
Okay, let me see if I have it. Okay, still do it. Very good. And so that was resolved. But the cool thing over there was getting on to amateur TV. He's got that whole setup. So, what'd you say, 26 types of ham radios? Well, I could check one more type off that I've done. In fact, there was one fella on in Wantore that we were talking to. And naturally, I got a big kick out of that. So my son-in-law is also a ham. So we both got to try out ATV over at Andy's. So, a terrific experience. Big color picture, P5 picture, as they say, and wonderful. He's got a big tower over there with a 20-element beam pointed toward Wantour, and it'll really work quite well. Unbelievable. Back to you, Ed.
KC2YLQ.
WW2W.
Yeah, Pete and Anthony recognized in that order. When it comes to the equipment that Andy has to do troubleshooting, he's got a solder sucking machine, so it was very easy for him to remove the solder on the four leads of that bridge rectifier to really confirm the bridge rectifier. You have to sort of remove it from the circuit. And that's how he confirmed that the diodes were good and that the capacitor that it feeds is good. The way many of the switching power supplies work these days is that the pure 110-volt line has no transformer. It just goes straight into a bridge rectifier. The peak voltage of your 120-volt line is 167 volts, so your bridge rectifier charges the first capacitor to 167 volts, and then the switching transistors do all of the work on that. And they regulate the voltage output by way of either pulse width modulation, or in some cases pulse frequency modulation. But pulse width modulation is the most prevalent circuit. Two separate FET transistors were running in parallel to give the right conduction for that switching function. One of those transistors turned into a pure short circuit where all three leads got welded together internally. When he removed that from your circuit, he found out that all three leads are shorted together. The other power transistor that was in parallel with it, the switching transistor, appears to be good. Andy didn't have that exact power transistor, so he wasn't able to do the substitute for you. And I guess he's in the process of getting you a substitute transistor. Also, there is a steering network of diodes that feed the gates of those switching transistors. This is an integrated circuit that does the pulse width modulation circuitry decision, that does the voltage regulation out of this power supply. And we're going to assume that the integrated circuit is good, but some of those steering diodes on the gates, particularly on the shorted transistor, failed. But replacing those diodes are easy. Getting the exact an exact replacement for the switching FET transistors is going to take a little bit of time, but it looks to me like you're well on the way to getting a repair there, as I see it, Paul. And looks like you went to the right place when you went over to Andy's house. I kind of thought so. He's well equipped for testing circuits just like that. And so now you saw what it's like with a little bit of experience. Let me drop. What you could have done is nowhere near as elaborate a troubleshooting as Andy was doing, but we now know that had you used your ohmmeter right across the plug that goes into the wall, you would have probably found out that you're getting at least a normal voltage diode drop from your bridge rectifier into that first capacitor. That first capacitor feeds the transformer. The far end of the transformer primary goes to the switching transistors, which are directly shorted to ground. A switching power supply also needs a fancy startup circuit. I mean, as you first plug it in, and as the voltage is slowly rising meaning a millisecond of rise time, the switching transistors have to have a time delay circuit that waits till the voltage comes up to the right number before it starts doing its action. Because the switching transistors themselves are capable of acting like a short circuit during the intermediate voltages. I've heard some people claim that a switching type power supply in a brownout could sometimes get into a little bit of trouble. It's made for a particular voltage of input. Then again, there are other kinds of so-called universal power supplies of the switching kind, where whether you plug it into 120 volts when you're stateside, or whether you plug it into 240 volts if you're in Europe, the circuit just readjusts its pulse width modulation, and after the switching regulator, you get the exact same voltage to all of your integrated circuits downrange. So there are some kinds of switching regulators that are very universal. Some of those will take anything from 400 volts input all the way down to probably 50 volts input and still run your circuit correctly. They got ridiculous ranges. In other words, electronically, they're switching a lot better than if you had a primary transformer with a whole bunch of taps and there's no primary transformer there. So they've got a lot to offer. Some of them, though, the switching regulators, let me drop. Some of them run at frequencies like 100 kilohertz of switching frequency. And so you've got to be a little bit careful with the filtering because, in theory, it could be a comb frequency generator where it's generating harmonics every 100 kc all the way up the band. It's a frequency marker, if you know what I mean, depending on how well designed and how well filtered and so on. So there's a lot to be learned. My son is studying for his master's degree right now, and one of the courses that he took as part of his master's degree in electrical engineering, was switching power supplies. So the name of the course has got a more elaborate name than that, but that's the main subject of discovery, a main subject of study. Let me finish with you, Paul. So is there anything else you want to tell us? I guess Andy is now in the standby mode, waiting to find some parts to do the substitution. He's slightly concerned that in the process of replacing the fuse a number of times, a little bit of extra damage could have occurred in the circuit. I don't think so. He's concerned, but I think he may be just overly conservative. Once he replaces the bad switching transistor, and because it's probably not an expensive component, he probably is going to buy a pair of them, so he has the ability to replace both of them if need be. And I think you're going to be back in good operation once he replaces those switching transistors and those steering diodes that are on the gate circuits of those switching transistors. I think you're going to be back in operation. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, it's been my experience when the blocking diodes that are on the gate are shorted, the driver got fried.
Okay, so the integrated circuit that does the bolts with modulation could have been also damaged. Maybe yes, maybe no. What's your guess as to the price of that particular integrated circuit if it does require repair? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Happen to know what number it is?
He probably does not. But give me a guess. Is it $5 or $35? Which would be your guess, Eric? Go ahead.
Probably $1.29.
For $1.29, the Paul I know, he's the last of the big spenders. He'll just peel off that money and pay it and said, no problem. WS2N, you got it, Paul. K2RIW, we're spending your money for you.
That's okay. I think I got it. Probably in that couple of hours over there, I probably got the equivalent of, maybe a $500 course in repair work and layout of a switching power supply. So, if you go back to the original story, this thing could have been for anything. You know, it just happened to be for a TV. You could buy the board. You know, it might take some doing, but you could buy the whole board and replace it. But I always find it more interesting to find out what exactly failed. You know, that's the fun part. And I went as far as I could, but now going over there, wow. You don't realize how much there is to know until you go over to Andy's house. Wowie. Unbelievable. Good education. Equipment all over everywhere. Everything neat. Put it all, boy. It's quite a place. And then the ATV experience was really a blast. Very cool. Back to you.
Now you're getting some idea of the value that Andy has. Andy works for an employer which periodically requires a vector network analyzer. Now that can be a $30,000 instrument, a fancy spectrum analyzer, some other kinds of fancy equipment, a service monitor, IFR service monitor. So we're talking about $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $30,000, pieces of equipment. Periodically, his employer needs a piece of equipment like that. And then they go scurrying around saying, gee, where can we rent one of those? To which Andy will say, yeah, I've got one. I'll bring it in tomorrow. I guarantee that George drops from time to time as he does that. Sounds like you're well on your way, Paul, and keep us informed as to how that troubleshooting goes. And I'm with you. I like fixing things. Yes, the quickest way is to write a check and buy a new module and just plug it in and make the problem go away. Quite often it's the quickest way, but there's a lot of education, as you can see, of troubleshooting, and you're going to be hearing a lot more about amateur television, which, as you probably know, this particular repeater group way back in 1975 had something called the Amateur Television and Technical Net that was run by one of the founders, Ed Piller, W2KPQ. That was back in 1975. And you probably saw Mike, W2OTA, and his beautiful pictures that he can send from Wantagh. He's been into a amateur television now for 30, 40 years, and he's got all kinds of fancy effect generators. He's got stuff that's 10% of what Eric's got at his place of business. Okay, Anthony, sorry we didn't find you earlier, but Back to you. WW2W. K2RIW. You got it, Anthony.
Hi, Dick, Mel. This is Anthony, WW2W. I'm in Bay Ridge. I understand you had a detailed and lively discussion before. I checked in from Long Island, and by the time Howard got me home in Bay Ridge, I couldn't make it from the car, so I apologize about that. My question is about the skin effect versus metal. The penetration of the electromagnetic field, conductance, whatever you would call it, into a certain metal, let's say, let me drop it a second. Okay, let's say, for instance, aluminum, copper, and silver. Given, let's say, tubing, the same thickness, circumference, and even frequency you're putting through it, let's say 100 megahertz. Okay, if you... I've heard it said that silver has a higher, better conductance, but let's say that will give you a higher Q and perhaps a stronger field. Wouldn't a stronger field cause less penetration in the metal? Perhaps these things even out, where maybe all of the metals give you almost the same skin effect. And if not, why would it be? Let's say aluminum give you less skew than silver. The field should be a bit weaker, maybe a very small amount weaker, but wouldn't that give you more penetration? Why or why not would it give you more penetration or less of the skin effect, so to speak? Back to you, Dick.
I think I know what you're asking, Andy. There is a very well-respected formula which allows you to calculate exactly what the skin effect will be. The formula is a 1 over square root function. In other words, the numerator is 1, the denominator is the square root sign, and inside the square root sign is bulk resistivity, rho, of your particular material, aluminum, copper, silver, whatever. The mu effect, whether or not there's any magnetic effect of your material, and the frequency of operation, and another constant. I think there's a 2 pi in there or whatever. The bottom line is that as the frequency goes up, it's a 1 over square root function. As the bulk resistivity of the material goes up, it's a 1 over square root function. If you look at the difference in resistivity or conductivity of copper versus silver, there is a difference, but the difference is small. It's only a few percent. Aluminum is a significant increase in resistivity. So in other words, the skin depth of aluminum, maybe it's going to be 50% greater than it would be with copper, and copper versus silver are going to be so close that you won't be able to measure the difference. But let me give you a gut feel for what's going on here. Let me drop. You're most likely going to be making your RF circuit out of copper, much more likely than aluminum. Not only is aluminum for an RF circuit harder to use because you can very rarely get a good solder joint to aluminum, but because it doesn't conduct as well, and most resonant circuits are small. I mean, if you're running, if you're Con Edison and you're running wiring for miles and aluminum is cheaper than copper, yes, you're going to be using slightly larger gauge aluminum, but in the case of the RF circuit where you're using a couple of inches of the material, the cost of the raw material is not the main determining factor. So therefore, you're more likely to use silver or copper if you want high performance. By the way, the word Q, which means quality factor, is a quantity that's used more with reference to resonators. Depending on your particular LC circuit that's doing resonating, depending on the quality of the capacitor, the quality of the inductor, and the load that you put on it, on that resonator, how well you load it down with the source and the sink, so to speak, really determines the overall bandwidth of the circuit, which is 1 over Q times the frequency, center frequency you're operating at. When it comes to skin depth, people usually don't use the word Q. They use this 1 over the square root function, that particular formula, which is easy for you to look up. If you simply Google the word skin depth or a skin effect plus Wikipedia, you'll get a whole page full of information that's very, very useful. Let me drop one more time. What you're about to discover is that for most of the frequencies you're likely to be using, 3.5 megacycles for the 80 meter ham band, all the way up to, let me say, 1296 megacycles for that particular ham band, you'll discover that throughout much of that frequency range, with copper as the resonator, the skin depth is in the vicinity of 1/10,000 of an inch, is where the RF energy penetrates into the copper, and at that point you're down to 37% of the current and decreasing as you go deeper. The first 67% of the current is flowing through the top 1/10,000 of an inch of copper. So the bottom line of this is that if you make your the tubing of your particular circuit, whether it be an antenna or a resonator or whatever, and if you made it, let me pick a number, 5/1000 of an inch thick tubing, as opposed to something that's thoroughly solid copper, there's a huge difference in cost and weight, but there would be essentially zero difference in performance of radio performance, because the RF energy is only going down something like 1/10,000 of an inch when you actually do the calculation. You'll be kind of amazed. And there's a bunch of explanations as to why RF energy doesn't go any deeper than that. And for the time being, just accept the fact that it's true, and I don't think we should tend to spend the time right now explaining as to why. But you just have to accept that. I wonder if that makes some sense so far, Tony. Whiskey 2 Whiskey, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Oh, okay, Dick, WF2W here. Yeah, okay, well, I was basically wondering, I guess, what formula or explanation would explain what the balance would end up being and why. So that's sort of the answer that I was looking. I guess a rule of thumb, we have to be happy with a rule of thumb type of formula, because perhaps there are more answers that, like you said, go more deeper into physics if you want to get something down to, your answer down to 2%, which really doesn't matter at that point, because you're still just going to be tweaking the circuit anyway. Yeah, 1/10,000 of an inch, and the price and the, you know, the how it's going to be used, of course, makes a big difference. All right, I think I appreciate it, and I guess you could toss it around there. WW2W.
I'm going to give you a couple of more sentences that will help make this a little bit more understandable. And we don't have to go to an RF frequency to see the principle. We can do it with high voltage direct current, so-called static electricity. If I was running a Van de Graaff generator, that's that machine that looks like a globe of metal with a piece of insulated tubing coming down the center to a base, and there's a belt inside, and the globe, once the machine is running, will easily get up to numbers like 200,000 volts. If you took a wire from that globe over to your circuit, and if your circuit happens to be a metal sphere, you've got an aluminum or copper, it doesn't matter, metal sphere, and you've got a little bit of a hole in one side, and with your wire that's being charged up by the Van de Graaff generator, you reach through the hole and touch the inside of your metallic sphere. Common sense would lead you to believe you're putting a high voltage charge on the inside of that sphere. Okay, you make that contact, you see a little bit of a spark happen, you extract the wire, and then you do some testing on that sphere. You will find out that on the inside of the sphere, there is zero charge, no voltage, no charge, nothing on the inside of the sphere, even though you reached in there with your wire, and that's how you charged up the sphere. You'll find out that on the outside of the sphere, with equal distribution all around that whole spherical surface, all of the charge is there. Why in the world did the charge do that? Well, it's because these individual electrons are very, very tiny objects, but they got a huge amount of electrical charge per electron when you compare their size. Because equal polarity repels each other. Electrostatic repulsion is what we're talking about.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
We're talking about electrostatic repulsion. Each of these individual electrons push away from each other as hard as they possibly can. They really don't want to get near each other. If you took two electrons and you tried to, by some magic, with insulated rods, push them together so that they touch each other, as they got very, very close, tremendous amounts of force would be required. They've got a very strong amount of electrostatic repulsion because they're equal in charge. Well, when you study what each individual electron is trying to do, get as far away as it possibly can from all of his neighbors, and yet still be on the metallic surface because you haven't provided any other path by which they can leave. When you put that all together, and they're going to be as far away from each other as they possibly can be, there's no other place they can go except outside of your sphere with equal distribution around the whole sphere. That's what happens with static electricity. You could say your RF waveform during the positive half peak is one kind of charge on that sphere. During the negative half cycle of your RF waveform is the other kind of charge. In either case, all of those equal charges on your metallic surface are pushing away from each other, and they're only forming on the surface. That's half of the story. What goes on with conductivity and Lenz's law, there's a lot more to the story, but at least you get a little bit more of a feeling of why. You've got half of the story as to why all of the charge will be on the surface and on the very thin 10,000th of an inch of the surface when it comes to most of the RF frequencies you're going to be working with. That's part of the reason why you can start off with some pretty yucky material for a conductor like plastic, and simple do electroplating of silver on top of your plastic. You could be building waveguide with that technique, for instance, and your waveguide, whether it's made out of plastic with a few thousandths of an inch of silver, as opposed to waveguide made out of completely solid... As opposed to waveguide made out of completely solid silver, the plastic waveguide with silver plating and the completely solid silver waveguide would have essentially equal performance. So as you can see, you can save yourself a whole lot of money and weight once you understand some of these principles of operation. Back to you, Tony. K2RIW in the SECNAT.
It's K2RIW, whiskey to whiskey. Yes, that would explain a lot, and I guess those charges on the inside and the outside would probably add up to zero, theoretically. But obviously there would be a tremendous potential from the inside and outside. And I guess that's why lightning bolts also seem to just be followed by the surface of metals or whatever they hit, rather than actually conducting through them. And of course, lightning bolts contain a tremendous amount of frequencies, static all over. But anyway, yes, thanks for answering the question, and I will look up online for the various mathematical formulas to satisfy more of my mathematical curiosity of it. K2RIW, whiskey to whiskey.
Dick, time.
Yep, I know. When it comes to, you said formulas, there's really only one formula. And the formula is not an approximation, Tony. It's an exact formula. When you go to that webpage and you get to Wikipedia and Skin Depth, Skin Effect, you'll see a formula, which is a 1 over square root with a bunch of terms inside. And as long as you know those terms, you know the resistivity of your material, the copper or the silver, the frequency you're operating at, and whether there's any magnetic properties of your material, you plug them into that formula, you get an exact answer. Not an approximation. There's not multiple formulas. There's one formula. This particular phenomenon you're discussing is rather well understood. There's not a great deal of mystery on this one. There's mystery to people who haven't been exposed to it, and as a learning curve, we've all got to go through to find out why it acts that way. But there's a lot of history behind this one, and you'll be discovering that as you go to that website. Okay, we're about to pick up with the younger people who sign in to Mel with their emails. But let me give a quick call to Pete just to find out. He probably had a piece of information from the previous material that we've already discussed. KC2YLQ, K2RAW. Go ahead, Pete.
Thanks very much. I wish I actually had information. I have two really super quick questions. First of all, thanks for recognizing me. As you may remember, I'm a newbie, and I came on air last week with you guys. So the first question, quick question, I've got a 40-meter dipole, the G5RV Davy, which only goes to 40 meter, and I was able to communicate on the 80 meter band today, and I wanted to find out if anyone thought that was a strange reaction, or if that's just a normal possibility with even with 40 meter band. The other question is, I need a local source for a really long copper grounding rod, 10, 12 feet long, somewhere here on in western Napa County or as close as possible, and wanted to see what anyone thought. So back to you. Thank you.
Pete, I didn't make it clear. I thought you were presenting to us information with the previous subject that we've been discussed. I didn't know that you were requesting that your name be added to the list at a later time. We've already made up the list. I know you signed in last week. And right now, we've got to, according to our schedule, we've got to go over to our mailbag, which is going to take us a good 45 minutes or so. The TechNet itself runs until midnight. After that, we'll discuss your particular subject as long as you want to, but we can't do that right now. A little bit sorry about that, Pete. KC2YLQ for any comment. K2RIW on the TechNet.
I understand completely. Thanks very much. Look forward to hearing the mailbag questions. Out.
Okay. You'll be able to hang in there a little bit later, Pete. Go ahead and wait for the beep.
I'm going to try and hang on if I can. If not, I'll catch up with you another time. Out. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you did sign in, and we didn't get to you. Automatically, you're number one on the runway next week if we don't get back to you tonight. QSL, Pete?
Okay, I recognize that. Thank you very much, Rich. Over and out.
Okay. Mel, I hope you didn't get the huge number you sometimes do. I know there are times you've gotten 300 emails. I hope it wasn't quite that heavy this week. But what was the major subject of questioning? K2KEY, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Well, a lot of the questions, of course, are basic subjects that we have covered, and I briefly refer them to amateurradio.tv. However, in continuing with the young people that are making comments about, so far they've been very interested in what we've been telling them about how to set up the basic bench, how to get the hand tools together, getting a basic meter, and they all seem to like that discussion last week, especially about use of a volt ohm milliamp meter, regular analog type versus a digital. So that seems to be unanimous that they all want analog type instrument. Now, the next thing, the question, they've been collecting boards. The group has been gotten together and it's picking up all kinds of things in the street, monitors, the TVs, the VCRs, all stuff that's being discarded, electronics. This one area, I think, most of the streets are going to be very clean of it. And taking it apart, they've been unsoldering parts, they've been mentioning. And the problem is they don't understand. We'll do a little discussion on identifying what they're finding in the way of components. Let's leave it at that and discuss that over.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a website that'll show you what a typical, and by the way, the majority of printed circuit boards that you'll find in commercial electronics made in the last 10, 15 years is almost a 98%, I'm going to say, surface mount components. The previous century of electronics, the majority of components had what called axial leads. In other words, a resistor was, let's say, an eighth of an inch diameter object, usually brown, probably a third of an inch long, and in the long dimension there's a wire coming out of each end. Those are called axial lead devices. And those resistors, the leads would be bent over at a right angle and plugged into a printed circuit board or brought over to a group of standoff insulators where the lead got wrapped around some little post and then got soldered into position. That's the way electronics was built in the previous century. In the last 15 or so years, almost everything is surface mount. Under your microscope, let me drop.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
All right, I just want to forewarn you, the mass-produced VCRs, specifically the VCRs, okay, besides having the huge chips that have everything in it, they don't have surface mount resistors. They are painted onto the board, so be
course to that.
Wow. And I thought I was working with modern-day circuits. I get exposed to things being used by Motorola as well as other companies, and I see primarily surface mount resistors, 0402s, 0201s, 0603s. Those are the sizes. 0603 means 60,000 by 30,000 is the width and length of the resistor. So I've seen primarily surface mount resistors, surface mount capacitors, surface mount integrated circuits. So you're telling me that there is now a resistive ink that represents the resistor, and when it's being done that way on a modern day, you did say VCR, and I'm a little bit confused about that, because aren't VCRs being considered obsolete by comparison to a DVD and and three-dimensional DVD, if you know what I mean. So if I try to compare the size of the printed resistor that you're describing, the ink type of sprayed-on resistor, would it be equivalent to a 0402, Eric, KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Guys are getting away from the subject.
I'm going to let him answer this one question. We'll get back to it. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, you'll find them smaller than 402s. They're like 206s. They're actually painted on. If you look at a modern-day DVD machine, which happens to be in a large box, will have a fairly large-sized board with little black things that look like carbon. They're flat. There's no width to them. They're literally painted on the board. They've been doing that for about 8-10 years now on the mass-produced VCRs, which is what you're going to find in the junk pile because people are not using them much anymore. And they're winding up on the garbage pile, you know, for the garbage man to take away. But the capacitors, they haven't figured out a way to paint them on the board, but most modern consumer, we're talking consumer electronics, you will find there are very little parts that you can remove these days. A lot of the stuff is literally painted on, and the really intricate circuitry is no longer individual gates or individual anything. You'll find one board with a bunch of this stuff painted down and two or three big chips, and that's the whole thing.
Wow. Am I in the dark ages? And maybe, Mel, you've seen, you don't allow your neighbors to throw away a VCR without you taking it apart and looking inside. I wonder if you've seen things like this. The capacitors usually are cream-colored. They usually have a dark band on one side. That's a rectangular cream-colored object, about less than an eighth of an inch long and maybe a 30,000th of an inch wide, 20,000th of an inch high. And quite often, if you look with high magnification, you'll get a clue that the capacitor is a capacitor because it'll say something like 20 microfarads at 35 volts. It'll say 20M on one line and 35V on the next line. And there's a plus and a minus terminal on it. That's the way you can recognize a capacitor. I still think printed circuits are, not printed, I mean surface mount resistors, little black objects with a silver band on the two ends, and quite often there's a number on there, like you might see the number 103 representing a 10,000 ohm resistor. 10 followed by the first two digits tell you a number, the third digit tells you the number of zeros you add. So 103, if you look with your microscope at a black object, is probably a 10,000 ohm surface mount resistor. Maybe that helps a little bit. K2KDY, K2RIW.
Guys are running it too far ahead again. Hold on, let's get away from the surface mount. I told them don't even look at that stuff right now. Put it aside. Let's talk about these picking up. They're picking up, I told them, TV sets and VCRs from the beginning, early ones. In fact, they mentioned that the ones that they picked up were like top-loading VCRs, you know, pop-ups where the cartridge went in and things like that. It had manual tuners and all. They found them in basements. And they took the boards out, and they're loaded with resistors and capacitors of the old type that are wired onto the board, and ICs, soldered connections of the old type of boards and parts as we had back in the 60s, 70s, or 80s. I should say with the VCRs, mostly 70s and 80s. Those are the types of boards I told them specifically to look for, TV sets and all. Now the point is, let me let it drop. Okay, now, the identification, this is where the problem seems to begin. All right, as you started to say, let's talk about what a resistor looks like. The resistor has a color code on it. How do you read the color code? That's it. Now, the color code is based on a standard color code chart. I believe they call it RTMA. I think you'll find it in. It gives you the colors, and they tell you what each color means. And how do you know how to read it? You'll see on the end of one, on the end of the resistor is usually a silver band and or a gold band. So that you'll read it going towards one of those bands. So basically, I guess the color code, I believe, is in standard. They haven't made any changes in that, correct? Over.
Yeah, that RTMA, I think it's called, color code, which I think was established something like 1915, 1920, way back in the dark ages. And there's a acronym that people use. It's a little bit profane, and that makes it easier to remember. You probably, I'm going to let you tell them what the color code acronym is, but it's black, brown, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, white. And if you assign to those series of colors 0 through 9, you will then know what you're looking at. If, for instance, I was looking at a resistor that is 100 ohms, I can write the number 100 by 100. The first one would be represented by brown. The second digit, the zero, would be represented by black. The third zero, which is the number of zeros, I want one more zero, it would be brown. So therefore, a 100 ohm resistor would be brown, black, brown as a color code. And then the fourth color band, if it was there, is telling you the percentage of accuracy of its number of ohms. Gold, I think, is 5%. Silver, I think, is 10%. And no fourth band at all, I think, is 20%. So maybe you want to tell them the usual acronym, if you've got a friendly way of giving it. Bad boys, blank, our young girls, but Violet gives willingly. That helps you rememorize the black, brown, red.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Roy G. Biv.
Roy G. Biv?
Easy one, Dick.
Okay, go ahead, Mel. How do you remember that color code?
Eric just said it. Roy, name Roy, R-O-Y, his initial G, and his last name Biv, B-I-V.
Negatory. Those are the colors you get for a rainbow. That is not the color code on a resistor. Over to you. That Roy G. Biv is not going to give you black, brown, red, orange, yellow, green, and so on in that order. Over to you, Mel.
That's the way they always taught it.
Okay, Roy?
The only thing you got to remember is black and zero. Other than that, you use the name Roy, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, Vic. That's the way they taught it, Eric. Eric and I were in the same class, over.
Every Tuesday I comment.
Hold on now. In the case of Roy G. Biv, where does white come in?
Those were the exceptions you had to remember. Black, brown, and white.
So there's a whole lot of missing colors. Ed, how did you get around this one? Ed, go ahead.
Maybe through ZI comment.
Comment.
Okay, ZI, give me your full call letters and name, sir.
K2RW, this is Alpha Bravo 2, Zulu India. Name is Kevin. The clean way to remember is bad boys race our young girls behind Victory Garden walls. Get some now is the last three. Over.
Okay, that's one way of doing it. Mel, back to you.
Okay, well, with Roy G. Biv, and then just had to remember the other three, and that was it. separately, but that gave you the major, you know, major color arrangement. But all right, let's not get carried away with ourselves. You can look up, as Dick says, the RTMA, Radio Television Manufacturers Association, I believe it's. So is that what it stands for, RTMA, over?
I'm sorry, I need that bad boy to repeat that.
Okay, Mel's going to give it back to you again. I think that's the correct abbreviation for RTMA. Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, you'll find it in any book. Or just remember, yeah, the bad boy business and all. To me, it's easy to just remember Roy G. Biv, and then just have to remember black, white, and that's it. A couple other colors that you can easily remember. Okay, let's stay with what we're doing now. So those are the resistors, basically, to look it up, get the color code, and begin to, let me drop for a minute. Late, we're going to lose the audience here. Once you've got that color code, you write down the value of what's on that resistor. So Dick just said if you happen to have a resistor that has brown, black, brown, that would represent 100 ohms. Put your meter on there. You put it on, say, the R times 100 scale. It will go to 1. In other words, it's R times whatever it is. It'll be reading 100 ohms on there. That means the resistor is, if it reads 100 ohms, or approximately close to it. It's not going to read exactly. A few ohms up or down don't make a difference. Don't discard that part. It's still a usable part if it's it could deviate a few percent. Don't make any difference. So that's one kind of part that you're going to find very prevalent on the board is resistance. Now, they'll come in all sizes, and they can have the same resistance, but in different sizes, physical sizes, because that is another part of a resistor called the wattage. You want to make a comment on that, but stay with the subject, please.
Yeah, that's tough. Okay, we'll try, Mel. So, on the small axial lead resistors, which means usually tubular object with the leads coming out the long dimension, so there's a lead coming out the north end, a lead coming out the south end, and you get this tubular object trussing, going from the north to the south end, if you know what I mean. In the case of the Japanese-made very small resistors, they look a little bit more like a dog bone, so a little bit more bulbous on the end. But we just gave an example of a 100 ohm resistor, which would be brown, black, brown, and an 8-watt resistor. I'm not sure of the exact dimension, but it's a little bit more than a 16th of an inch in diameter, and probably a little bit more than 3/16 of an inch long. The physical size of the resistor tells you how much heat it can dissipate. In theory, a 1/8-watt resistor, when you go through the formula of current times voltage drop across the resistor, that equals watts. There's three formulas for watts. You can calculate it three different ways. Voltage times current going through the resistor, and voltage drop across the resistor. Number two, E squared over R, where E is volts and R is ohms, or I squared times R. Any one of those three formulas. EI, that's volts times current, E squared over R, or I squared R. Whichever one is convenient to you, that tells you how many watts the resistor is dissipating. Let me drop.
Heading away from the subject.
You did want to know wattage. Back to you, ML.
Oh, I just want you to describe what the difference in the resistors means. Smaller resistor means less wattage. Larger resistor means diameter. More capable wattage. Let's leave it at that right now, because they're going to just sort parts now for projects. We'll talk about what will be necessary in the future. For the most part, the projects they're going to work on, whatever resistance, small resistance they find on the board, will be sufficient. Let's talk about how to just to identify these components. Okay, so we know with resistance, you'll put aside resistance. You can put them aside by first the resistance value. Let me let it drop. And by the physical size of them. You'll sort it that way. In other words, you'll put all your 100 ohm resistors in but the ones that all are of one physical size resistance in one group, but another one, like you'll have 100 ohm little one, then one a little larger, and all that for another, but they are still the same resistance. The wattage is another factor, but we'll